It's session number 10308, Reel 2.
Mr. Martin, Reel 2.
Yes, and to enable the officers to organise this collection of grass, I can remember that they converted lorry chassis and put a long tow rope on with crossbars on it, and maybe 10 or 12 prisoners, one each side of each crossbar, would pull this into the countryside, and they were allowed with a Jap guard to cut the grass and take it back in and squash it. And I don't know how they squashed it, but it was a foul liquid, and I must say that I thought about it. I took what I could get of it, because I felt that it was not wrong. That was one of the peculiar things that they even made their own soap. I remember also they started to make their own soap. Clothes were a problem in Chang'e. It wasn't so bad at first, but later on it was very difficult because there was no cotton in the economic area that Japan controlled. The cotton came from countries other than where the Japanese were, so that clothes were at an absolute premium. But I will say that the system they ran before the Japanese took work parties out, and I got that as 8 weeks, roughly, it may have been six, it may have been nine, I can't remember really. Our own officers insisted on cleanliness and discipline, and looking back, we used to call it bullshit and so on and so forth, but there's no doubt about it, I'm sure that was one of the things that in the early days stopped morale crumbling to absolute rock bottom. Looking at it sensibly now, I'm sure of it. And the fact that they charged people with various things if they made rules, and they actually gave them punishments in a prison camp. Almost unbelievable, but true.
Do you remember any incident occurring at Chang'e about the POWs refusing to give parole to the Japanese?
Yes, I do remember it, because that was a Selarang incident. But by then, that was after they'd started taking work parties out, and I'd been marched down to Singapore into the River Valley Road to the camp, and I was working on go-downs, stores, docks and so on. And I still had my army paybook, in fact, which is signed by an officer to say that I'd had to sign this Japanese document, because, of course, you're not supposed to say you won't escape. And as I say, I've still got my paybook with that in. And horrific stories came back, and in fact afterwards I met people that had been there, and it was really quite dreadful. The Selarang Square, which was simply surrounded by blocks, were they two or three story high, which had been used as barracks in peacetime, was simply I don't know if it was wired off, but they put machine guns at each corner, so I'm told, and put the whole of the prisoners, sick and everybody, from that were left in Chang'e into that area, and said, until you sign, you stay there. And they didn't send any food in or anything. And of course, there were no toilet facilities, nothing. They started to dig the square about. So I was told, I wasn't there, I was in River Valley. And our people wouldn't sign in River Valley, the officer commanding, our English officer in charge of the camp. They always put officers in charge of us. And through the orders mainly came via our own officers to us. So I think perhaps that was a mistake by the Japanese, because perhaps it was a language difficulty. But the point is, you are far better dealing with your own officers than ever you would be with the Japs trying to tell you this, that and the other. However, our officers in the end heard the news that they'd given in, and we all had to sign the same paper. That was, as I say, we were actually out in a working camp in Singapore at the time.
What about the Japanese methods of supervising work?
Well, they were always shouting at speedo, but we became, I think, past master of the art of looking busy and not doing a lot. They took us out from this camp. I remember one or two interesting incidents in this particular camp. At one time, we were on a special job somewhere on the go-downs at Keppel Harbour area, and we were loading out of a go-down for about a week. Out of a go-down, myself and about five others, out of a go-down into Japanese transport, and these goods were being taken away, and they just detached us to do that job. And we thought to ourselves, well, how can we make this up, you see? And this is absolutely true. So each day we decided, when the guard dozed off, at lunchtime as it did, and we had our bit of rice and so on. We took it in turns, and when it was your turn, you had to urinate into the petrol tank. When you'd urinate into the petrol tank, that was it, put it back, and so the each day for a week, the lorry started off from the docks, and it would get to the dock gates, and you'd go, pff, 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 and come to a stop, and we'd all be stood in the back, looking very innocent. And after the second day or so, I remember, well, he twigged something was going on, and he got us all out and gave us a good hiding and put us back in again. So we packed at him, because by then he'd realised, you see, it was obvious. And it, the first two or three, it may have gone on 4 days, I can't remember, they sent another lorry out, and we thought, oh, that's good, it's wasted a bit of time, and it was a bit of a jolly for us, we were perhaps young and a bit daft, I don't know. But that was an absolute fact. I can also remember working in a Japanese food go-down, and we were detached for odd days, and at lunchtime, the Chinese in the cookhouse were quite friendly, and some of us, they gave us some food, and I can remember very well, I had an old sun hat. What do they call them? Topi.
Topi,
yes. Before I got rid of it afterwards. An old topi which I wore, and it was quite high crown, high, big space in between, which was fortunate for me, between the top of my head and the top of the hat. And they gave us some potatoes, I can remember, and they were quite a luxury, because they came from the Cameron Highlands. And I put them in a little bag that I carried. But then, to my horror, there was a search on the way out. They didn't always search. And they searched, and they found two or three in front of me and gave them a thorough good hiding in front of everybody. Really beat them up. They couldn't hardly stand with to sort of hold them back. And I thought, well, what am I going to do? So I had about half a dozen spuds, and I took them off and put them in my hat. And I stood with my hat on top of my head. And they came and searched me, the line for everything. And they didn't find them, never moved the hats. And that, so that was quite a near shave as far as I was concerned. It really put the wind at me. I worked in a laundry from that camp. We used to steal the needles out of the machines and sell them in the black market. We stole everything we could steal from the Japs and sold it to the Chinese. We became very good thieves.
Was it easy to contact the Chinese?
The Chinese were always willing to do a deal. Very pro-English and anti-Japanese at that time. I can remember I had, the only private article I had left because the kit bags had been bombed, was my 21st anniversary gold signet ring, which my mother had bought me. And in the end, I decided to sell it so that I could start some trading. And in the River Valley camp opposite, on the road opposite, there's a, I can see it now. In fact, I went back to Singapore and had a look at it, so it's still there. There's a long row of Chinese houses, low houses, and right opposite them was the guard house, or a guard point for our camp, with a man perpetually on guard, a Jap guard. And I can well remember, and this is absolutely true, we all clubbed together, because we were getting 10 cents a day pay, I think, $3 a month, which initially wasn't very good, but it was even worse later on when inflation set in, obviously. And we gave him about half a dozen of us clubbed together, and we gave him, I can't remember the amount, but he was very happy to take it, and he let us across. So it was in the early days when I'm on the crest of a wave still, and they didn't worry too much. They let us across, and I flogged my ring. Can't remember now how many, but I did get a receipt for it, and I went to the pawn shop afterwards, but unfortunately the British had bombed it, so it wasn't there, otherwise I'd have got it back. They were very, very straight, the J. If ever you did a deal with it, they never robbed you. And he, when I went the next time, gave me the money. There were no argument. He didn't keep it and then say, sorry, I didn't get it. He gave me the money. Absolutely, absolutely straight. And then I used to, while there were still things about, when I was out and when it was possible, I used to buy things like eggs or whatever I could, and then go back to the camp and sell them, and at the same time make a little profit and eat some myself and so on. But of course that fairly rapidly dried up, because there were no more supplies coming into the island because of the naval blockade, and eventually your money wasn't worth very much anyhow. I mean, I can remember a sheet of newspaper cost, I think it was $5, and you only earned $3 a month, and that was for smoking your cigarettes in if you had any tobacco. So it was six or seven weeks' wages to buy one sheet of newspaper. So most of them stopped smoking, of course.
What kind of physical condition were you in, apart from constipation at this time?
I was fairly fit, actually. And when we went down to River Valley, the big worry was that you would... My worry used to, I used to think, what if I fall ill here? Nobody's going to care. Of course, your own people did care up to a point, but there's nothing to treat you with. This was the problem. It was bad food, long hours of work, and no medical, or very little medical relief. Very little at all. I mean, for malaria, they had nothing. You just had malaria. And after about 4 days, you had to go out to work. Well, in peacetime, they sent them home.
Did you get malaria?
Yes, I had malaria, yes. I had malaria. I had beriberi. And dysentery. No, I never had dengue fever. I didn't have cholera or anything like that, fortunately. So I was really quite lucky. And I kept fairly fit. I was always out on working parties. River Valley Road, I was there for quite a while. I can't tell you how long, but the notes I have... Can I refer to this?
Yes.
If I may. We first of all were clearing secondary jungle and putting up go downs for the Japanese, being in the engineers. And I can remember an incident which made me think that sometime I ought to learn some of the language, and eventually I did. As engineers, we were in charge of the derricks. They were simply a very big telegraph pole type of thing with four ropes on, and a prisoner had it. Four prisoners had ropes and they were wound round supports in the ground, and they moved it forward from the bottom and the top. And the Jap started shouting, and it was with these things we lifted the principals up. And he shouted and shouted, and he went to it. In the end, we said, oh, it, that's blue pencil it, you see. And we just let go, and it fell down to this day, and it took a long time to get it. So he came round, he gave us a really terrific good hiding, there's no doubt about it. He knocked us down and gave us a hell of a good bashing, kicking and so on, because we'd done this. And the big problem was, your own officers, nobody understood Japanese. And the Japanese didn't really, many of them, speak English. But eventually they got organised so that each camp, and I can't remember how long it would be, but each camp seemed to have an interpreter, either an English or a Malay, Singapore volunteers, or somebody that could speak Japanese, and used to go out with parties. So it helped a lot. But it was also quite obvious that if you could speak Malay or Japanese, that you're going to be a lot better off.
So how did you go about it?
Well, I met a Dutchman, Max Lammering, very nice man. He's dead now, unfortunately. But I became friendly with him, and he'd been a planter in Sumatra, and he was brought over as prisoner by the Japs to work, and he spoke English, German, French, Dutch, Chinese, Japanese, Sundanese, and Bunese. He spoke about 10 languages, and I became very friendly with him. And I told him that I would like to learn a little bit about the Japanese, so that is why my little book has those verbs and things, and I started writing them down and so on, so I could learn. And then, unfortunately, he got notice that he was going to move. They were going to move him in another 2 or 3 weeks. So he said, what are we going to do? Well, I said, have you a book? He said, no. He said, oh, I've only a Dutch-Japanese book. And it's in phonetic, you know, the Dutch word, and then it would be phonetically Japanese. So he said, the problem is you don't know Dutch. I said, no. Well, he said, I can give you the rudiments of Dutch if you'll work hard on it each night. The rudiments, he said, then you can have the book. And that's how I progressed, actually. And I picked up the usual local phrases for how much is it and it's 2D and all that sort of thing in Malayan. But if you didn't know that, you couldn't do any deals with the natives. Although a lot of them spoke English, certainly a lot didn't. So I think it's one of the most important decisions to learn the language.
How proficient did you become?
Enough to do a deal. And enough to have... I would never have made an interpreter, but enough to understand and pick up what they were talking about when they came to you. And that was very important, because you could then say to the lads, well, look, he's going to tell us this, that and the other, and they'd watch themselves. It was very important. And since the war, I went out to Bali and Singapore. I swore that I would, having worked outside the Japanese Kempeitai, which is the secret police headquarters in the Raffles Hotel, we used to unload boats, I swore I'd go back there after the war. And I went back, and actually my Malayan came back as easy as nip. Very useful, the language.
What kind of contact did you have with the Kempeitai?
Only I can remember the Kempetai stopped, for example, the guards letting us out as things got worse. They stopped the guards letting anybody out. So you went out at daylight and you came back at dark, and that was it. You couldn't get out because they stopped it. Things weren't so good. And I can remember them also coming into the camps in the night time and looking for wirelesses and so on. They used to come in at funny times when you're least expecting, I suppose, because there appeared to be means of receiving official news in almost wherever you were. It was quite amazing. And after the war, I remember, when we were free, but before we came home, I remember seeing, they had it on display in the camp I was in at Cranji. It was half a water bottle with water in the top half, and in the bottom half was a little radio, and they could get deli on it. And the news was passed around by word of mouth. It was unbelievable. Quite unbelievable.
Can you take me a bit further in your narrative now?
Yes. After the various various work jobs we did in River Valley Road, and you don't mind me referring to this, do you?
No.
We were taken back to Changi. We'd finished the job we had to do there, so it was building the go-downs and doing certain jobs on the docks. And we were told that, in fact, we were going back there because all the prisoners were going to be taken to a land of milk and honey. This was quite openly said to everybody. It was going to be a land of plenty because we're short of food here, which we all knew. We're going to take you up country to a land of milk and honey. So everybody went back fairly cheerfully. But as soon as I got up there, for some reason, I got dysentery. I had a poisoned arm, and it was at that time, while I was in the hospital with a poisoned arm and dysentery, that in fact they were sending thousands of these prisoners off by rail up to Thailand, and as we found out later, the notorious Quai Bridge incident and the Burma Railway. So that it was fortunate that I was ill at that particular time, because I missed it. They wouldn't take people that couldn't actually walk, although they did take people that worked very well, obviously. And by the time I came out, they'd more or less all gone, and there were just the ill and the camp staff left. And that time, I spent probably the easiest time of the whole lot. I had spent 3 months on the camp gardens, and that was it was long work and hard work, but it was easy because one chap didn't care. You're inside the wire practically all the time, and you could eat fairly well. They allowed you a bit of potato tops and all that sort of thing.
Are we still in 1942 now?
We're in April 43 when I returned to Changi. So that would be in 43 when they started sending parties up north, I think. But none of these are guaranteed dates, but approximately right. And then they moved us into the Changi jail itself, and we were put on building the airfield at Changi. We were then sleeping, or I was in one of the cells, three of us, one on the block, one each side, with the feet in the toilet thing, and you slept alternate nights. Every third night you had the block, and otherwise you slept three in a cell. And very boring work and very hard work. And I really don't know how long that went on for, but I've got to note it was boredom and physical strain and mental strain and disease with a low diet. And apparently we had the daily ration of rice then was about 8 ounces, which is not very much.
Were you getting anything to supplement that?
I was taking rice polishings and the grass liquid, I've got a note of that, and a lot of the men still wouldn't take it, and I used to take it on purpose. If they didn't have it, I would, if I'd got any cigarettes from anywhere, because speaking the language, I could also wheedle cigarettes out of the Jap guards. And those, and some men were fools, they couldn't break the habit. They would part with, say, their rice polishings for cigarettes.
When you say rice polishings, you mean the husks?
Yes, which is the vitamin part, which was also issued, as well as the liquid grass for vitamins and so on. And there was a certain amount of rice polishings issued also, which were quite terrible. You just stirred it into water. It was like eating sawdust.
How did your diet compare with the Japanese guards who were supervising you?
Very much less in bulk, but yet of a similar type, but they would get a little meat and a little fish and rather more vegetable. We would have basically rice, with a very small amount of vegetable. I can remember walking outside the jail, and as we walked towards the airfield, which is about a mile and a half away at the most, there was a hibiscus hedge. And it got around that the leaves were very good to eat. Well, in a matter of days, there wasn't a leaf left on that hedge. People had plucked them as they went past. I can remember. Yes, we ate them, certainly. And I made friends also with some of the Eurasians who were in the Singapore Volunteer Forces. And they showed us there was sort of a mushroom growth, a fungus that grew on rubber trees. And there were certain of those you could eat. And you could also eat certain of the snails. And those were eaten, and the mushroom fungus were eaten, and certain green leaves were eaten.
Did you eat snails?
Yes. A little snail farm at one time. But somebody whipped them all, so it didn't last long.
What did the snails taste like?
As I remember, we used to boil them and boil them. We boiled them once originally, and they were foul. So we boil them and boil them, got rid of all the taste. And then they're a bit like veal, almost. Not very much taste in them at all. Not very much taste at all. I think they're overrated. Never bothered with them since. Same as I never eat rice pudding and don't buy Japanese cars. So, I remember, well, Padre Duckworth. Who was a wonderful fella, because some of the officers weren't very nice, but the majority were okay. And he was a great guy. I remember him well. While we were in the jail, he had a place outside, which I'm not a high religious man, but you worked, I think, 9 days and one day off. And on your 10th day, you could go to a little service he held. And he actually was one of the best officers I ever met. He's dead, so he died since. But he was an absolute humanitarian and mixed with everybody. A superman in every way. Good morale builder, the lot. But not a Bible thumper in that sense, to be truthful.
What was wrong with the officers whom you have reservations about?
Well, they still received a lot of pay. And they ate, at that time, comparatively well, because they could buy on outside. They were allowed to buy. There was a canteen. But they were really practically the only people who could buy anything. And we got our 10 cents a day, I remember. $3, which really wouldn't buy hardly, it would buy hardly anything. And they received officers' pay a certain proportion according to rank and so on. And I know they lived quite well because they even had a separate cookhouse. Now, Padre Duckworth ate in the men's cookhouse. Very different was the diet. And there's no use complaining because, I mean, nothing happened, did it? And this was a big problem. There were no vitamins, and even now I'm still vitamin conscious. You can't help yourself. I don't know where the Bob is. But most of the people I've met since that were in Singapore, Malaya, are very faddy about the food. It's something that stuck with them. Because I say, love makes the world go round, but you can take it from me, it's food.
Very faddy in the sense of being...
Well, they want decent food. Yes. Yes. They're aware of what is good food, what is good for you and what isn't. Absolutely right. However...
So you were saying that you were doing this... boring work. You're
yes.
In 1943.
Yes, making the aerodrome, helping to make the aerodrome. We were moving. There was a hill sloping to the sea and there were swamps, and they were moving that hill by hand, prisoner of war labour, into the swamp and levelling it off, which is now the modern Changi aerodrome. And each day we used to go down. We had to fill skips on a light railway gauge by hand with shovels. Then we had to push them down to the swamp, tip them up, and a little engine used to pull them back because it was a bit too much of a slope for us to... And always, and it was an interesting incident, always, before they... you had to tip the skips over, as you would in a quarry nowadays, by hand. You know the type of thing I mean. Then when they're all tipped, he'd give a little toot on his engine, poo-poo, and start pulling the train away, and you'd get on and have a ride. Well, one day, and it's absolutely true, I have a note of it... he started to pull away without pipping, and I was still on the line like that, and it ran over my foot. The train wheel, I remember very well, ran over my foot. But the thing is, and I couldn't walk, obviously, broken the toes. They managed all right, but the Japs wouldn't allow any transport. Your men, after a day's work, had to carry you back to the Changi jail, which was ridiculous, really. But then, nothing as against probably what happened on the railway, but they didn't really care about humans. Not really.
We hear so much nowadays about Japanese industrial efficiency, but did you find that their work methods were efficient there?
They were very industrious and very disciplined. There's no doubt about that. I think the discipline was very strong. And I believe, as individuals, they worked hard, yes. They did. They were the odd one, but basically, I think they were hard workers, and they were very well organised and industrious. Very hard workers, indeed, honestly, yes. I would say that.
We hear a certain amount about the contrast between Japanese and Koreans. Were you able to distinguish between the two?
Yes. The Koreans tended to be a little taller and so on, and we in fact had Korean guards at Changi Jail. And, we didn't like them at all. Whether they were awkward to please their masters, I don't know. But we considered them worse than the Japanese, our particular experience of them.
Harsher?
I would think so, yes. Not quite apropos of that, but it reminds me of an incident when I was taken in front of, I think it was a Lieutenant Takahashi, and he spoke good English, but he wouldn't speak English, you know, when it was an official inquiry on. And we've been delegated as a party of engineers to dig a well in the grounds of the guards' houses outside the jail. And we had to dig this well, and it was hot, terrible work, and you're always hungry and not feeling very strong. And at lunchtime, we used to go and steal the food out of the waste bins, which was purely rice, because the Japs eat in a very hygienic way. They scoop it into the mouth from the tin. They don't actually touch the food. Not that that would have stopped us, but that is how they eat. And the rest of the rice and so on goes into the bins. And they caught us, and they took us in front of Lieutenant Takahashi, and through an interpreter, and he understood English perfectly. He said, "Why did you steal this food?" And I can remember saying quite clearly, "Well, I was very hungry, and if we have to work, we need to eat." And, you know, nothing was said about it, and I was just marched out. That stuck in my mind.
But that was untypical, was it?
Untypical, I would say. But Takahashi wasn't a bad fellow. It was mainly the individuals under him that were...
What did the Japanese attitude towards British people seem to be?
British people? Well, you mean the nation or the English soldiers?
Both.
I can't really think, but they were full of propaganda, because I can remember them drawing pictures in the sand showing the Thames, and they were bomb. They were bombing London. They had no idea. The propaganda. And Australia. They were bombing, and they owned half Australia. And they really believed they were bombing London. That is a fact. I can remember by the private pointing it out.